Ever wonder what motivates people to get plastic surgery? Did they regret it? What can we learn from the stories of plastic surgery patients? We're here to explore those questions and get some of those answers today from my guest, Ellis Yance, on the Plastic Surgeon Podcast. Hello, my friends. Welcome back and thanks to our listeners for the amazing feedback. We have had so much fun so far and look forward to more of your insights and suggestions. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts to get more great content. On the Plastic Surgeon Podcast, we listen to real plastic surgery stories of triumph and pain from real patients and providers to further understand why they would risk their life under the knife. I'm Dr. Javad Sajjan, and today my guest is the amazing Ellis Yance. Hi, Ellis. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you. Thank you for being here. We're here to talk to you about your journey, how we came to know each other, the procedure you underwent, and how it affected you.
Cool. I'm ready.
Ellis, what surgery did you have with me?
I had the double incision top surgery.
Awesome. And that's a gender-affirming surgery.
Correct.
Yeah. Tell our listeners what a gender-affirming surgery is, Ellis.
For me, at the very least, it's any surgical procedure that you would go through to help align how you view yourself internally to others externally. So aligning the inner self with the external self.
And the surgery I did for you is not a mastectomy, but that's what it's most similar to.
Yes.
So people call it a mastectomy. And what a mastectomy is, it's removing breast tissue. So what I did in your situation, like you said, is what's called a double incision chest reconstruction with free nipple grafts. Mm-hmm. Now, free nipples doesn't mean they're free, right?
Right.
A lot of people think that.
Yeah.
So what that means is I remove the chest tissue or breast tissue. We then liposuction the chest to create more of a masculine contour. The nipple and areola were resized, reshaped, and they were positioned more in the male position. Mm-hmm. To help our listeners understand where you're coming from, so what was your gender assigned at birth?
Yeah, I was born female and I lived as a woman for the first, I want to say, like 13, 14 years. Mm-hmm. And that is when I started getting on the internet. I was in the cosplay community where mm-hmm. we dressed up as like anime characters and video game characters.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people there who are assigned female at birth and only cosplay male characters. And I was kind of one of those people. Mm. And dressing that way, having the wigs and stuff like that kind of like did something for me.
Sure.
And being online, learning more and more about the trans and LGBT community. My dad also knows a lot of trans and LGBT people. I kind of started thinking about it and thinking more about that aspect of my life mm-hmm. versus just accepting that I was born that way and that's how I had to be.
So what's the difference between gender assigned at birth and gender identity?
So assigned at birth, what most people coined the term for is just a quick way to say what you were, the hardware, organs, whatever you were born with. A lot of people, at least in the younger LGBT community, specifically the trans community, seem to not enjoy having to talk about their assigned gender at birth mm-hmm. or even the term. But I just try to view it in like a medical necessity type way. Like mm-hmm. if I went to a hospital, they wouldn't ask if I was a trans guy. They would ask, you know, does he have a uterus still? Mm-hmm. What type of things are we dealing with medically? And so I kind of just view like people need to know what I am working with
sure.
in that aspect versus, you know, if they respect that I am a man. I've been living as a man. That is my identity versus my body parts.
And one of the controversies or topics of debate people talk about is, should we even assign a gender mm-hmm. at birth? Or do we leave it like X or blank or mm-hmm. not say anything? If you don't mind sharing, what's your view on that?
I think, again, like for the medical aspect of it, like a baby is born not knowing it exists. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have a concept of gender yet. And raising your kids, giving them the option, not saying that like with my family, for example, my sibling has always been very gender neutral. So my mom kind of was accepting of that. Like, this isn't going to be my little princess daughter, and that's fine. So I think, you know, understanding that my kid was born female, so they're going to have a period at some point, they're going to go through a female puberty at some point, that aspect is important. But also allowing your kids the freedom to tell you, like, I don't feel aligned with this, or I'm not sure I feel aligned with this. Can I have, you know, some opportunities, or can I get someone to see for this? I think that's more so important. Assigning a gender at birth really is just to understand what we're working with and aspects of medical necessity.
Do you think that when someone's a child, and we'll just use under 18 for that mm-hmm. reference point, right? Because that's what we use right. overall in society. Do you think they have the knowledge and ability to understand gender?
I think to certain aspects, yes. I do think a lot of what we think of when it comes to gender and gender stereotypes are just societal influences. I think if you took a kid and went out into the sticks in the woods and raised them without any social influence, they would come into their own. However, you know, they wouldn't take the societal views of a woman or societal views of a man and allow that to change who they are or to interfere or give them an impression of how they should be. I think, like, for me growing up, when I was like 4 or 5, my mom's favorite story to tell was how I asked her when I was going to get my beard or how I would hang out with my dad and, you know, he would be building stuff shirtless. So obviously I would be too. Mm-hmm. And then after a certain point, you know, around 7, 8, my mom's like, you can't do that anymore. And I didn't understand. I was like, well, why? Because I'm the same as him. Why can't I? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was much of a, oh my God, I'm trans in my kid brain thing. It was just like, I'm the same as this. What makes us different? Mm-hmm. And I kind of carried that into my adult life where, you know, people say normal guys and trans guys. And I'm like, I get it when you're going categorically, when you're trying to separate trans from cis. But also it's like, there is no, the only difference is what you make of it in mm-hmm, a way, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Some people, you know, believe that it's appropriate if your child has a gender identity that's not congruent with what they were assigned for the parents to, or in the child potentially, to do medications mm-hmm. and invasive therapies. So let's just talk about that for a second, because I want to understand your definitely. View. What do you think about puberty blockers, and can you tell us what they are?
So from my understanding, puberty blockers are just like a neutral hormone that helps subside the effects of a hormone-based puberty.
Correct. Yeah, they block, like, you know, they block the hormone from influencing gender. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. I also, like, it's funny that you asked, because I was thinking about this on my own the other day. Mm-hmm. I didn't go on any blockers. I went through a full estrogen puberty. And then when I was 17, a month to being 18, I asked my doctor about going on hormones because I personally wanted to wait until I knew it was something that I wanted to do, even though throughout, you know, my teenage years, I knew that I wanted to go on hormones eventually. I think it is a very tricky situation with mm-hmm. puberty blockers, just because I think it's at like 13, kids are legally allowed to take some sort of initiative with their medical health, like their mental and physical health. Like mm-hmm. that's when the doctors can't like tell your parents if you are sexually active or if you're, you know, going through something, they have your confidential. It's a little bit more confidential. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it is just very tricky because I have known so many people personally who started testosterone or started estrogen at a very young age, and then now they're realizing that's not something they wanted.
Hmm. So are some of these people that you know, are they detransitioning or are they just not wanting hormones?
I have known both. I have some people, like some friends that I know that live overseas, where they go on and off using hormones just because they're non-binary. So mm-hmm. they want some of the effects, but not all of them. And then I had a friend who we were friends for a pretty long time, and I knew him through his whole transition. And then I learned like 2 or 3 years ago, detransitioned, is a girl again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, obviously so happy that they were able to figure all this out. But it also sucks being, like I said, I grew up on the internet in that age mm-hmm. and kids there really were like, pressuring each other to conform, even in the trans community. And so I feel so, like,
what do you mean by that, conforming the trans community?
There's a lot of like back and forth, especially I think I'm only 22, so I'm still very, very young. Mm-hmm. And with the internet, and especially with COVID, so many people are inside and, you know, looking more into themselves and seeing what they're interested in or who they are as a person. Mm-hmm. And there is just this ideal, at least back in my day, of what like a trans guy was and a trans woman was, and non-binary wasn't as much of a thing even then. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so now, like, I got told back the day, because I still am very feminine, obviously. I wear skirts and makeup and dresses, but I see myself as just as much of a man as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, I got told that I was giving the trans community a bad name because I was a trans guy who wore dresses and skirts. And so I got pressured, or at least felt pressured, to identify as non-binary so people would respect me in the trans community.
Huh.
Which is something that not a lot of people talk about. And I've talked with many, many trans guys who've had the same experience.
Wow. And I've really seen an increase in gender identity as non-binary.
Mm-hmm. So most definitely.
So when I started doing gender affirming surgeries, I would say if I did 100 surgeries, maybe two or three would identify that I'm talking gender transitioning mm-hmm. from female assigned at birth to male, top surgery, or facial masculinization or body masculinization. Right. I would say out of 100, maybe two people would call themselves or identify, I should say appropriately, mm-hmm. non-binary. Now, I would say it's easily 50.
Yeah, I see them all the time on your Snapchat and stuff. It's crazy. And I'm also so glad that these people have somebody they're comfortable with to go to about these things, because I will not pretend for 1 second to understand the world that mm-hmm. non-binary people live in, because it's so different. And I have majority of my friends that aren't cis are non-binary. And so I listen to them when they talk about it, and it sounds so much, in a way, so much more difficult than just being a binary trans person. Mm-hmm. Even though I am very gender non-conforming, like, it's still like, at least having somebody that can help them get the body they want. Like, I see a lot of the non-binary people choose to not have nipples, and I think that's super sick that you offer that too. Like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And do you think some of the increase that me and you are seeing of people identifying themselves as non-binary, do you think it's due to pressure in the trans community, or is it because people are learning that non-binary is more of an option?
I think it's more the latter. I think people are realizing, and again, like going back to the societal pressures of what a man and a woman is, I mm-hmm. think a lot of people are realizing that it's a social construct. Mm-hmm. We're all just animals who exist. Mm-hmm. And I think they're realizing that it doesn't matter as much. Like, if you're comfortable wearing skirts and being referred to as they, them, or being referred to he, him some of the times, or, you know, not having any pronouns at all, like, that's your thing. And again, like, I'm not going to sit here and voice and, you know, be a voice for them, because I don't understand mm-hmm. their struggles and communities. I'm just a trans guy over here. But I think it's really cool that they're finding their community and their voices are being lifted. It's sick.
I really agree with you. What I think it was happening, or that's changed now, is people didn't understand, like you said, that they had to, that there was a not more of a quote unquote non-conforming option, mm-hmm. right? People felt they had to fit either A or B.
Right.
But there wasn't an A plus B minus, if you will, right? Or A minus B plus. There mm-hmm. there wasn't something that where they didn't have to pick, right? Mm-hmm. They could be not conforming and live their life that way and still feel comfortable. And that's what I've seen the most.
And you even like take into consideration intersex people mm-hmm. who maybe like from day one, they didn't want male or female. And now that more people are talking about neutral pronouns and stuff, they're like, oh my God, that's something that fits. Or even going as far back as in Native American culture, the Two-Spirit mm-hmm. people, they've existed for years. And my boyfriend right now, he is Native, and the closest thing he can identify with is Two-Spirit. So it's very fun and interesting to see not only the newer ideas of gender fluidity and nonconformity also being kind of like shining light on older cultures that have had stuff like this forever and then kind of squashing the idea that it's a fad or it's a new thing for people to be non-binary, for people to be trans. And it's just really interesting. And I'm sorry if I'm just like talking so much.
No, you're great.
But I try to respect and pay homage to the older LGBT community as much as I can, because especially like the drag queens of color and the just trans women of color that really like legitimately paved the way for all of us. And so trying to learn more and more about the history of the LGBT community and the trans and non-binary community, I think is super interesting and a lot of more people should get into because it's super cool.
And I think people don't understand that transgender non-conforming people have existed forever.
Oh yeah.
Even if you look back thousands of years, it's existed. I think now because of the internet, it's more available and that's people are seeing.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, getting back to our puberty blockers.
Yes.
So do you think it's something that should happen or should people wait till the person is 18? I know 18 is an arbitrary age, right? What do you think about that?
I think it definitely isn't something where somebody should be able to go right into a doctor and be like, I want this, and then they immediately give it to them. Because I know, at least from my experience, I had a lot of other mental health things going on that could have swayed my decision. And so I think if somebody maybe, this is just circumstantial, they're growing up and they express to their parent some sort of disillusion with whatever their assigned gender at birth societal ideal is, that would be when the parents could maybe bring it up to a doctor, maybe a mental health professional, and say like, hey, you're more equipped to talk about this and to give the options to my child. Like, I know there's like gender specialists. Some of the therapists I saw specialized in gender, like transgender stuff. So they had worked with the trans community for a long time and they really knew a lot more than me when it came to the options. So I think when it comes to puberty blockers, it should be more of a, let's go through a like mental health professional and see what our options are. Cause then at the very least the kid can talk with somebody and feel like they have somebody in their corner and feel safe. Cause the most important thing about growing and trying to become a full person, in my opinion, is just having a safe person, safe place to grow and to figure that stuff out. I don't know if I would like jump on the gun to prescribe every child who shows any gender dysphoria blockers, because it could, I feel like, just cause more confusion, especially because as a kid going through puberty, there's so much going on in your brain. So I just,
that'd
be crazy.
And what about starting hormones as a child? You know, starting estrogen before 18, if you're male assigned at birth, or starting testosterone before 18, if you're female assigned at birth. What do you feel about that?
Very similar in that I think it isn't as easy as just, okay, I'm a trans guy, I want to get on hormones right now. I think there's a lot more that goes into it. Just thinking about,
like, of course,
everything.
Would you feel the same way about somebody having, now I do surgeries on people under 18. There's certainly many steps the patient goes through to make sure that they're safe and they're a good candidate and it's something that's indicated. Do you feel the same way that there should be some level of thoughtful decision-making, if you will, with therapy or stuff like that before doing surgery under 18?
I do, especially because, like, as much as 13, 20-year-olds don't want to hear it, sometimes people that are older than you do know better.
Yeah.
Sometimes they know what they're talking about, and especially with someone in your case where, like, this is your job. You do this every single day, all the time. Like, before my surgery, you were like, I just took 18 pounds of breast tissue off someone. I was like, oh my God. You know what you're talking about. So if you told somebody like, hey, I don't think we should do this surgery right now because you are 15, your body still has to develop in other ways outside of puberty. Let's wait and make sure that this is right, because I know at 15, there was things I wanted, especially with transition and stuff, that I don't want now. And so if I would have gone on hormones when I was 15, I probably would have had some gender crisis and then, you know, not known what I needed to do or what I wanted in general. So it's like being a teenager, you're still learning about who you are as a person. I think that's a really young age to change your body that drastically.
Yeah. And one of, you know, I believe in informed consent, but certainly I work with the patient and family to help make a good decision. And some, and I, you know, it's very rare that I'll say, I don't feel someone's a good candidate for various reasons. But sometimes I, when I do that, it's rare again, but some patients will say you're gatekeeping.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and they'll use a lot of buzzwords to brand me when I'm like the biggest, I would call myself probably the highest, I want to call myself the top or the best, but I'll say the probably one of the highest volume gender affirming surgeons, probably in this part of the country, if not in the country. And sometimes when I'll say, you know, I don't think you're ready yet. We need to do this. We need to do that. We should do this. Or I'll tell them, I don't think it's a good idea for us to do surgery at this moment. They'll get very upset. And sometimes they'll go on the internet and write reviews and say this and that. I remember I had somebody one time who was almost over, a little over 300 pounds. And they wanted to do surgery. And I shared with them, look, there's no question you want the surgery. I agree with you. This isn't my age, but if I do it, you have a high risk of, you know, of potentially having a major complication like death and all these things, you know, all these different things that can happen. And then they go on the internet and they write all these reviews about gatekeeping or fat shaming, which isn't even true. I myself, when I was a kid, I was very obese. So I've lived a life. I know what it's like to some degree. But it seems like you're more, you're comfortable with the doctor sort of using discretion to see what's correct.
Because again, like you went to school for a long time for this to be your job. And I think it would be very unwise and cruel for you to do a surgery for someone, even though you knew it could potentially be detrimental to their life. Like, that's one thing I went into with surgery too, is like, if I went to get top surgery, like I wanted keyhole, but I didn't know if I would be a candidate for that. And so I was even, I said to my family and stuff, I'm like, even if I don't get that, I'm going to trust his decision. I'm going to trust that he knows what to do. Because like, I'm not a surgeon. And I wouldn't want you to do something just because I wanted it done when you knew that it wasn't a good decision, or you do the surgery just to get like the money for it. Because I'm sure that would come up if you did start doing that. If you did start doing surgery on people because they wanted it so bad and they were willing to pay for it. And I don't think that's worth your name or your practice. It kind of sucks being told like, this can't be done in a safe way. But from everyone that I, because I've known two other trans guys who have gone to you, and one of them had EDS and crinoclasial dysplasia, and it went amazing. And that's something where that is a tissue disorder and a muscular disorder. And it turned out amazing. And he is like so happy living his life. And that is something where you, as a doctor, took the risks into consideration and made it work. So like, it's not like you're just anybody who poses any sort of difficulty. You're like, nah, I'm only going to take the skinny, the attractive, the, you know, whatever. You're just being like, I'm going to be realistic because that's fair.
Exactly right. So when I do surgeries for people, I would say some providers tell me I'm a little bit too too soft on my requirements, I would say. It depends on who you ask. But what I mean by that is when someone's over 18, if they want a top surgery, I believe in informed consent. So what that means is if that person's decisional, they can make the decision to have surgery. And as long as I feel they're safe and they're low risk, I let people decide what they want. So where I'm coming from is, if someone's over 18 and they want a top surgery, how is that different than somebody potentially getting a breast implant who's cis? How is that potentially different than someone doing some kind of, you know, reduction or something else? So I let them make that decision. And I want your honest opinion here. And I know you wouldn't be, you would be not be less honest, but don't tell me what I want to hear. But my question to you is, do you think that I should require people to go to therapy if they're over 18 before doing their surgery?
I think, if anything, just like, not maybe like a full, like, go for 3 months and that whole thing, even though from personal experience, it does take at least 3 or 4 sessions to really feel comfortable with your doctor. And I do know also, because of the gatekeeping situation and other surgeon's office and stuff, a lot of people will lie. And that, you know, in those situations, I'm like, Godspeed. If your doctor in like a little small town in Kansas is being that way and you have to tell them that you're dying every day because you have to live the certain way to get hormones, go for it. But when it comes to surgery, especially because post-surgery depression is a real thing, I think it is important at the very least for them to go to like 2 or 3 visits. And then also because in those 2 or 3 visits, that gives them the time to be like, if there's anything else I need to take care of leading up to this surgery, now I know what's going on, like, mentally, because you will be sitting and laying down for at least a week doing nothing. And that can do a lot to your brain, sitting in one room. I know, like, I got up and I went outside, but like, it's still a lot. And if you aren't prepared for that, or you haven't sat alone with your thoughts in complete silence before, that can be crazy. That can be scary.
How did it go for you?
Really well. Honestly, I think I had a very blessed and easy recovery. I rarely, like, only felt pain like in my lower sternum, like my abdomen area, and then like up here. But aside from that, I was fine. I live with my sibling and my partner, and they both took really good care of me. But there was a lot of time where I was up because I would have to take the antibiotics, and I would just sit there and be like, oh God, I really just did something to my body. I just had something that is irreversible. I went to sleep and then I woke up and it was gone. And even though every day it like being able to put on a shirt like, is just incredible. It still was something like, this is huge. I was born a certain way and then I went to sleep and woke up and I'm never going to have that body again.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, huge thing for you to go through as a person.
Did you have regrets?
Kind of. Only like 2 or 3 days. Like, I think after I got the, like, the 2 days after the first post-op where you get the big foam taken out, after that, when I would go and like clean my incisions, I would look at myself in the mirror. And I think it was partially too, because at that point I had to completely shave. And that was the first time I'd been hairless since really I started growing body hair. And so seeing how like just gnarly it looked and then completely hairless and just not being perceived by like outside people, like only being around and talking to the people in my apartment, I kind of just like stopped really knowing, like, it felt like I was just like in a bubble and the outside world was happening around me. And I was just having this like, who am I moment of like, oh God, everything's changed. But I think it definitely was just like the human aspect of like the little monkey brain being like, my body is hurt. That doesn't look right. And so then making your, like, your body going into like a, oh God, fear mode because it thinks you're hurt or it thinks that there's something wrong. And again, just the alignment of, I used to look like this for my whole life and now I look like this. And at one point I did like have a regret, like, I'm going to have to go through all this pain and is it worth it? Is it worth, you know, like looking like this and having the scarring and whatever. But, you know, every day that goes on, it looks better and better. And I've had so many people just be like, oh my God, like, this looks incredible. I have a friend who we became friends when we were like both 11. And then because of coronavirus, we haven't seen each other in almost a year and a half. And I went and hung out with her and we went swimming and I took my shirt off and she just started crying because she was like, you look so good. You look so happy. This looks right. Like, I can see in how you're standing in your body language that you feel better. And that made that makes it all worth it.
That's awesome. So let's say we delete what everyone has told you how you look. And we just think about Alice. Does Alice feel the surgery was the right thing to do?
Absolutely. No doubt in my mind.
Why?
Absolutely. I think because for the first time after the surgery and like after everything was like grown back, I've been able to like look at myself and like I see like that's what I'm supposed to look like. And for the entirety, like up until I had surgery, I knew like I could look at myself in the mirror and knew what my body was, quote, supposed to look like, you know, like I knew how I looked in my mind. And with hormones, you know, having facial hair, having fun colored hair, like that's how I feel like happy. And it makes me feel good to have these things. And with top surgery, it just makes me so happy. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain. It's one of those things where it's like when you look at yourself and you have something and it's just right. Like, I feel like everybody in some way has something about themselves where they're like their hair, their eyebrows, or, you know, their legs, and they look at it and like, this is just how it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so like soul healing.
I understand.
I feel like that's like maybe more so like a trans experience, but I don't know.
How were you, or were you concealing your chest before surgery?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I had a binder.
What's a binder?
So a binder is in the trans community. It's like a very tight tank top or undergarment. Usually it's like a spandex and like a polyester. Some sort of tight thing in the front. They also, Under Armour, they make them for sports people or for people with gynecomastia. Gynecomastia, yes. And mostly what they're for is just to flatten the chest and conceal as much as it can. And I'm very lucky that my chest was very small before surgery. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time, too, I could get away with just wearing a sports bra.
Okay. When did you decide you wanted to have surgery?
Really, the first inclination that it was something that I wanted was around like 14 or 15 when I had the thought of like, I would rather be able to add this and have it when I want it and have it none of the time than have it all of the time and then take it away when I want it. You know, like I would much rather have my chest be flat all of the time. And then if I wanted to dress up or I do drag every once in a while, I can add breasts if I want to. And that is just so much easier because I know I'm happier when it's flat. So I'd rather just be like that all the time. Mm-hmm.
Then when you started thinking about having surgery, how did you hear about me?
I did a lot of research. I've had like your the Allure Aesthetics page bookmarked since I was 16.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How old are you now?
I'm 22.
Wow. Yeah. That many years. So that's what, 6 years almost? Mm-hmm. And how did you hear about me at 16?
I started looking into surgeries and I started looking into hormones. The person I go to for my hormones is Linda Gromko from Queen Anne Medical Association. Absolutely adore her. She like made everything a breeze when it came to my transition, as well as my therapist Tara, who adore Tara. She's incredible. But when I started talking about surgery, she said like there's a lot of good surgeons in the area. Sajan, I've worked with a bunch, you should check him out. And so I kind of went through there. There's a lot of trans guys on YouTube that I watched, but the majority of them were not in Washington. And when I did like a Google search for like best top surgery doctors, Seattle, Washington, you popped up and you were in my area. Everyone else was like Bellevue, Redmond, way far out. And seeing how you had not only videos of you doing the surgery, but you had videos like with your patients and photos and just the pure amount of testimonials and reviews that you had made me feel really comfortable. And again, following you for those 6 years and just seeing your stuff grow and you get better and better. And it just, there was no doubt in my mind that you were the person I wanted to go to.
That's awesome.
And then, sorry.
No, it's cool. Go ahead.
Just having my two friends as well go to you and have incredible results and nothing but good things to say. It just, again, like solidified, like, okay, this is definitely the person that I want to trust to do this.
And when you say you were following for a few years, were you looking at the social media channels or just the website? How were you following?
I followed you on Snapchat for a really, really long time. And then every once in a while when I would like be thinking about it, I would be like, okay, well, let me just check. Let me just look again to make sure. And so I just kind of always had the tab open and I would just click back. And then every once in a while I would see there'd be new photos. And I was like, okay, because I wanted to see like what people had chest sizes similar to mine or body types similar to mine. Because I wanted to get like the best idea I could of like, what will this look like on my body?
That's cool. You know, I have to say, as much as I would like to say and believe, you know, I was, you know, the surgery I did day one was the best, I have to say it's an evolution.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
the surgery I do now, I would say what I did in the beginning was amazing. But what I do now, I would think is another level.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you, so when I do surgery, I follow all my patients for 1 year and I look at their results. And every time I see someone, every surgery I do, I take something away and I get better and better. Because every body type is different and every body type heals differently. Mm-hmm. So when I think about my surgery today, I would say it's more, each operation is more unique to the person.
Yes.
Because I see different bodies and how they respond to the operation. And I think what really separates somebody from being good to being world class or, you know, the best in the world or whatever is understanding not how you respond or how you do the surgery to the masses, but how you treat each individual mm-hmm. body type and being able to generally predict where that's going to go. Mm-hmm. And I would say the more you do, the better you get. And that's the nature of it. But you have to think and reflect. Some people just do it and keep moving. For me, I do the operation. I think about what I did. I note what I did. And I try to understand how can I make it better? Or why did this person have this edge of the incision turn out this way versus this, right? And it's a constant evolution.
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing to hear and hopefully for other people listening as well, because I don't think you ever want to go to a doctor that thinks they know everything.
Yeah.
Or that thinks that they're the best of the best. Like, you deserve to have a bit of an ego because you really are one of the best.
Thank you.
Like, I've told multiple people too that I have a couple friends who one wants a breast reduction and one wants top surgery. And I was like, if you want someone that's going to do like the best, absolute best he can, but be very honest with what you are going to get as a result, Sajan gotcha. Because like he said, like you really do take every opportunity to learn and to see what you can gain in knowledge wise from that situation rather than just like conveyor belt people out.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Such a pleasure talking to you, Alice.
Yeah, I'm again thrilled that you guys contacted me and wanted to hear me talk about stuff.
Thank you for being our guest today, Alice. Yeah. Your story is so unique. Your thoughts are so insightful.
Oh, thank you.
Every time I do a podcast, you know, it helps me understand my patients better. And I really appreciate that. I feel it makes me a better doctor. Mm. I've learned a lot from your ordeal. I know your ordeal teaches our listeners how and what to expect as they start their own individual journeys. I appreciate, I'm honored to have you as my good patient. And I would even say friend.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Plastic Surgeon Podcast. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts to hear more great content. For my live surgeries on Snapchat and my adventures throughout the week, catch us on all social media at Real Doctor Seattle. See you next time. Bam. One.